criminal. My brother just said, absolutely not, in this very matter-of-fact tone. Of course, both of them said due to their hectic lives, they couldn't do any more than what they were doing. When I told them we had no choice, they said it was cruel, and they wouldn't help pay for it. She's still living in her house. I still go over there every day on my lunch break or after work. My brother and sister choose to think everything is just perfect, even though my mom is getting worse, and it's getting more dangerous for her to live by herself. And me, my marriage is on the rocks. My boss is always pissed, and I'm at my personal breaking point. Chelsea's story captures many of the complexities of caregiving. After we look at motherhood, and a few of the shared triggers around perfectionism, we'll examine the resilient strategies that can help us reality check the expectations that make this complicated issue even more difficult. Motherhood. While motherhood and parenting are certainly related, they emerged as two distinct shame areas. Mother shame is about our identity as mothers, or our identity as women who are not mothers. Parenting is shame focused on how we raise and interact with our children. Mother shame is an overwhelming issue for women. Every single participant in a mother role identified mother shame as an issue. And because motherhood is an identity that is so closely tied to being a woman, it became clear that you don't have to be a mother for motherhood to be a shame issue. As we learned in the powerful guide on understanding infertility, women struggling with infertility talked passionately about the mother's shame in their lives. So did women who have chosen to delay having children, or not to have children. Society views womanhood and motherhood as inextricably bound. Therefore, our value as women is often evaluated by where we are in relation to our roles as potential mothers. In some communities, the expectation of motherhood has many layers, including norms of what's too young, what's too old, and what gender babies should be, as if mothers controlled this. Once women hit the age set by their community, they begin to feel the need to defend themselves against expectations of motherhood. Women are constantly asked why they haven't married, or, if they're married, why they haven't had children. Even women who are married and have one child are often asked why they haven't had a second child. Women who have four or five kids are expected to explain why they had so many. Mother shame seems to be a birthright for girls and women. On top of the societal expectation that motherhood defines womanhood, there are some very rigid expectations about what the good mother looks like. There are some very desirable qualities associated with motherhood, and there are some characteristics that are universally unwanted. Interestingly, to be perceived as trying too hard was identified as an unwanted characteristic, not only for motherhood, but also for all the areas in this category. We want perfection, but we don't want to look like we're working for it. We want it to just materialize somehow. Poof, there it is. You don't have the time or talent to look that messy. Even though I hear this every time I bring my stack of Meg Ryan pictures to my hairstylist, I still don't believe her. All I want is Meg Ryan hair. This last time I asked, I want to look like I just rolled out of bed. How hard can that be? She spit back, it takes 2 hours and 10 people to get that natural look. Get over it. We want to be natural beauties, natural mothers, naturally good parents, and we want to belong to naturally fabulous families. Think about how much money has been made selling products that promise the natural look. And when it comes to work, we love to hear, she makes it look so easy, or she's a natural. The research participants really exposed an interesting perfection paradox. Imperfection brings shame, and working too hard for perfection brings shame. In this age of instant gratification and celebrity for celebrity's sake, it's easy to understand how we've fallen for the idea that we can just want something bad enough and poof, there it is. How many of us have fallen prey to that saying, it shouldn't be this much work, or it just doesn't come naturally to me. It must not be my thing. Yes, there are naturally talented people, but for most of us, including the celebrities and superstars, achievement is about hard work and commitment. 95% of the people who are in great shape and have healthy bodies work at it a lot. I know several people who possess parenting skills that I really respect. They work at it. They talk about parenting as a skills-based job that requires training, practice, and a significant time investment. They read, they take classes, they practice, and they evaluate their techniques and strategies. The same applies to family and motherhood. There is a direct correlation between input and output. The areas in this category are like other skills-based endeavors. If you have reasonable goals, the more you invest your time and resources, and the more you practice, the more likely you are to reach those goals. A couple of years ago, a doctoral student told me, "I'd love to write a book. I've been collecting material for several years. I just don't think I can do it." When I asked her what was stopping her, she stared down at the ground between us and said, "It's not easy for me. Writing is so stressful. I'm not like you, it just doesn't pour out of me. Plus, I'm not very thick-skinned, and they say writers need to be able to laugh off criticism." I could sense that she felt some shame as she explained this. Part of me felt real empathy for her. The other part of me was a little pissed off. I stood there thinking, writing doesn't pour out of me. I tweeze it out one word at a time. Sometimes it's not too bad, and other days it's excruciating. And criticism, every writer I know struggles with criticism. You work at becoming better at hearing it, but it's painful, especially when it's personal. When we believe that success should be effortless, we simultaneously set ourselves up for shame and diminish the efforts of people who are working on their issues around perfectionism. We become part of our own shame web and other women's shame webs. How many times have we dismissed someone's efforts because we have bought into the expectation that family or motherhood shouldn't be that hard? Marriage, parenting, health, careers, motherhood. Each of these requires a tremendous amount of work. And trying to balance the demands of these five areas might be the defining challenge of our lives. We need to reality check our expectations. Just because we don't sit down and channel the great American novel in 1 week, doesn't mean we won't be good writers. And we need to remember that behind every naturally gifted person is normally a huge amount of work, dedication, and commitment. Defending our lives. When I spoke with women about the pressures of perfection, they were quick to explain that failing to look, love, and work perfectly was only part of the problem. Of equal importance is the shame that stems from what we are willing to do to appear perfect or hide our imperfections. When perfection is the expectation and or the goal, we are willing to put a lot on the line to maintain and protect our image. Here are some women's stories. Shame is being married for 20 years and never walking around naked in front of your husband. Not even once. I lie to people all the time. I tell them that my father lives in New Jersey. He's been in prison for 6 years. I'm more ashamed of myself for lying than I am of my dad for being in jail. It's one thing if your family is different because your parents are divorced or something. It's different if your dad is a felon. My husband had an affair last year. I haven't even told my best friend. Everyone loves my husband and thinks we are a great couple. I know if I told her, she would think less of both of us, not just him. I want to go back to school and finish my degree, but with my kids and my part-time job, I just can't imagine being able to do it like I want to. I'm afraid I'll get a B or C. I don't want to do it unless I can do it 100%, so I don't go. I just tell people my parents travel a lot. Last year, I was the only freshman in my dorm whose parents didn't come up for Parents Weekend. I didn't invite them. They are racist and hateful, and they think the whole world is out to get them. My dad thinks everybody owes him. When I was growing up, I was always embarrassed for anyone to come to my house. It's like they're from a different planet. I filter everything I tell my parents. They don't know I'm gay, and they don't know I have a partner. There's a lot of pressure in the gay and lesbian community to come out. I know it's important, but you have to be prepared for your parents to walk out of your life. Not many people have to face that reality. People at work always say everything she touches turns to gold. Sometimes it's true, but lately my projections have been way off. The first time I packaged a deal that lost money, everyone in my office freaked out. They blamed everyone but me, when in fact it was my fault. I made a bad call. The second time it happened, my coworkers did the same thing. That's when I realized that I'd become a poster child for the department. They couldn't stand the thought of me making a bad call. In this business, we just need to make more than we lose. No one makes money on every deal, but I'm expected to. My boss told me, we need you to show people how it's done. We need you to set the bar. Now I dread work. I've started lying about my numbers and blaming losses on other people. We are also more willing to use shame, fear, and judgment with people who threaten our pursuit of perfection. We can feel threatened when people challenge or criticize us, or we can feel threatened simply because someone is making different choices than we would make. This came up a lot around parenting, which is a particularly complex issue because we base our level of perfection both on how we are perceived as parents and how our children are perceived. As the examples throughout the book, and certainly several of the following ones demonstrate, we are very susceptible to using shame, fear, and judgment against our children when they engage in behaviors that damage the parenting image we are trying to create. When my husband and I told my parents that we had decided not to have children, they fell apart. They kept asking, "What's wrong with you? How could you do this to us?" My mom actually said, "It's a disgrace to the family. Everyone will think something's wrong." I had known it would be hard, but it was far worse than I imagined. My partner's dad was on one of his regular tirades, yelling at her about being lesbian. He was calling her a butch and telling her she was an embarrassment to their well-respected family. Then, right in front of me, he says, "And of all things, you have to be a butch with a colored girlfriend." I remember just standing there thinking, he did not just say that. We're not talking about Archie Bunker here. We're talking about a 50-year-old, over-educated oil and gas executive. Shame really causes people to act crazy. My husband is very tough on our son. He puts a lot of pressure on him. He wants him to get perfect grades and be the best baseball player at the school. I try to soften my husband up, but it never works. I see my son's stress. I used to talk about it with the other baseball moms, but I've stopped. They started giving me a really hard time. They said the other kids think my husband is cruel and unfair. The other mothers think my husband and I are ruining my son's life. I have no idea what to do. I just stay quiet. In more extreme cases, our inability to expose imperfections can mean putting ourselves and or the people we care about in real danger. When I was pregnant, all my girlfriends said, "Oh, just wait, you're going to feel a love that you've never felt before, it's amazing." They'd go on and on, and after my first child was born, my son, I got really depressed and I actually didn't feel anything toward him. I just felt sad and overwhelmed and really wanted to go back in my life to a time before I was even pregnant. To feel like that when you look at your new baby, I was so ashamed. I thought, my God, I'm going to be one of those mothers that, you know, my son's going to turn out to be a crazy person, and I'm a crazy person. My husband was so freaked out. I think he thought he was married to a monster. I don't think he knew what to say, and my mother-in-law just kept saying, "Something is wrong, she's not normal. Something is wrong, she's not normal." For 2 months, my life was a living hell. I wouldn't go to the doctor because I was too ashamed. Finally, when it got so bad, I could barely function, and I was afraid my family was going to put me away, I forced myself to go to the doctor. The doctor explained that some women experience depression after having a baby, and it could be based on my hormones. She said it could happen to me even if I'm normally a loving person. I got on medication, which that's pretty bad itself, but it's not as bad as feeling nothing toward your child. Within 2 months, I felt normal again. I just look back at that time and know that was the darkest place I've ever been. I'm ashamed at how much I absolutely hate my body. I mean, I hate my body sometimes so much that I wish I'd get sick. I mean, really sick, so sick that I'd lose 30 or 40 pounds. I don't want to die, but if I could just be sick enough, I don't even care how miserable I'd be, but if I could be sick enough to lose 30 or 40 pounds and then be well, it'd be worth it. I mean, can you imagine hating your body that much? It's like I'm ashamed of my body and I'm ashamed of how much I hate it. My daughter is on drugs and my son in junior high is failing school. When your only job is raising your kids and they're both failures, then you're a failure. My friends keep telling me I need to get help for my daughter, but I don't know what to do. I can't tell my husband, he'd go nuts. I know she drinks and drives, but if I take her car away, he'd want to know why. At some point, I realized that refusing to see a doctor because I was ashamed of my body and being overweight was tantamount to suicide. It had to get that bad before I could force myself to go to the doctor. Sometimes I have unprotected sex. I know it's stupid, but it's such a turnoff to guys. It's hard enough being 30 and single. I don't want to be the safe sex police on top of that. If I ask and they pretend like they don't hear or say they don't want to, I'm not comfortable making it an issue. As these quotes demonstrate, pursuing perfection can be as dangerous as it is unfulfilling. Sometimes the risks we take are not as obvious as the ones above. One example of this is my own struggle with being perceived as an overprotective and uptight mother. Between my experiences as a social worker and Steve's experiences in pediatrics, I've seen a disproportionate number of bad things happen to children. Sometimes it's difficult for me to tease out the fear from the reality-based concerns. Two issues that are particularly important to me are gun safety and seatbelts. If Ellen is invited to play at someone's house, I want to make sure there aren't loaded guns in the house. And I want to make sure that she's properly restrained in the car seat if she's going to be in a car. For the past few years, she's been young enough that we actually accompany her to playdates. But as she gets older, that's changing. Sometimes I find myself silenced by the shame of appearing obsessively worried. I don't want to be perceived as that hysterical, hovering mom. I've had to really reach out to my connection network for support and help reframing the issues. A friend of mine who works in a teen pregnancy prevention program told me what she tells the kids. If you aren't comfortable enough to talk about condoms with someone, that means you don't know them well enough to have sex. Now, rather than thinking, I hope they don't think I'm crazy, I think, if I'm too ashamed to talk about these issues, I'm probably not comfortable enough with these folks to let Ellen go to their house unsupervised. Perfectionism and shame resilience. To better understand how each of the four elements of shame resilience can help us overcome perfectionism, I'll share another story about one of my personal struggles with perfectionism. When I was pregnant with Ellen, several companies, including a computer manufacturer, had advertising campaigns that featured young mothers working from home. Invariably, the ads portrayed the mother in her bunny slippers, working away at the computer while her child gazed lovingly at her from the playmat situated right next to the desk. The commercials would always end with the mother simultaneously receiving praise and validation from her child and from her professional colleagues. I thought about that image every day. I wanted to be just like the commercial. I would picture myself in a cool t-shirt and size 8 yoga pants. I've never been a size 8. With a loose ponytail. I've had short hair for the past decade. A laptop. A cooperative baby smiling from the playmat. Exciting work and loads of personal and professional validation. Suffice it to say that someone at that marketing agency did their homework. I'm sure I was the targeted demographic, and I fell for it. Hook, line, and laptop. One day when Ellen was about 2 months old, my vision was realized. I was one of three researchers being considered for a community evaluation project. I had a phone interview with two community leaders scheduled for 1 p.m. I had everything scheduled down to the minute. Ellen nursed at noon and was sound asleep by 12:55 p.m. The call came in promptly at 1 p.m. I had all my questions prepared, a cell phone with a mute button, and a headset ready just in case. It was perfect until 1:05 p.m. About 5 minutes into the interview, Ellen started crying. Not screaming, but crying. At 1:06 p.m., she stopped crying and started screaming. She screamed so loudly that both of the interviewers asked if everything was okay. I quickly replied, "Everything's great. Please continue." As they explained the project, I went into Ellen's room, holding down the mute button and periodically testing its power by repeatedly asking, "Can you hear me? Can you hear me?" By the time I got to her crib, the front of my t-shirt was soaking wet with breast milk. Ellen had a certain call of the wild that would immediately send my milkmaking into overdrive. Ellen was screaming because she'd had one of those explosive poops that shoot up the back of the diaper and don't stop until the entire back of the onesie is covered. All of a sudden, as I'm evaluating the crib damage, I hear the dreaded, "Ms. Brown, are you there?" "Yes, I'm here. I'm just taking notes so I can more thoroughly think about the project. Can you tell me about the project funding?" Phew, it worked. As they started explaining important things that I should have been writing down, I kept one hand on the mute button, pushed Ellen up against the crib bumper, and slid her into my arm. Poop was everywhere. I managed to get her undressed, clean her off with a dozen wet wipes, and carry her naked back to my room. She was still crying, and at this point, milk was literally dripping off my shirt. I laid her on my bed long enough to get one arm out of the t-shirt, pulled my drenched bra around my waist, pulled the nursing pillow around me, and started feeding her. As soon as she was quiet, I came back to the call. I managed to make a few coherent statements before all hell broke loose. The stress of the situation was too much for my body to take. Within seconds, I was riding the wave of a serious diarrhea attack. At this point, I was standing up with the nursing pillow around my waist, tears pouring down my face, my t-shirt hanging down my back, and trying to do the pressed cheek penguin walk around the room. As gracefully as possible, I took myself out of the running for the position and thanked the interviewers for their time. I just sat there, holding Ellen and crying. I felt ashamed about my inability to pull off my vision of working mother perfection. It was one thing to take myself out of the running for the research position, but it was even worse to look down at little naked poop-smeared Ellen and feel like I had let her down too. A few weeks later, Steve and Dawn suggested that I apply what I was learning about shame to this situation. I'm no stranger to the shame research or heal thyself comment. As I thought about it, my shame turned into disappointment, followed by disillusionment, followed by a healthy dose of I'm never going to fall for that smiling baby laptop bunny slipper bullshit again. Now when my first-time mom friends tell me how they are going to work at home with their newborns, I'm quick to share my story. They often respond by asking, "Can't you just plan your work around the baby's schedule?" Or, "Can't you just make sure she goes potty before the call?" I lovingly tell them, only in the commercials. When I applied the four elements of shame resilience to this situation, here's what I learned. Recognizing our shame triggers. I did not want to be perceived as incapable of balancing motherhood and work. I did not want to be perceived as needing help. I wanted to be perceived as one of those laid-back, balance-everything, don't-need-help working mothers. I'm still not sure about the origin of the messages that fueled that identity. I know some of them came from what I saw growing up in my family. My mom didn't work outside the home until I was in my late teens. She was the room parent, the Girl Scout leader, the swim team mom, the carpool coordinator, etc. That's the picture I had in my head for me. But with work somehow added to the vision. I'd just do what she did, plus work full-time, and finish graduate school. The whole idea that something would have to give wasn't for me. That was for the other mothers, the ones who couldn't do it all. I figured that I belonged to a different group of moms. You know, the ones in the commercials. I liked their messages better. Buy this laptop and working from home with a newborn will be easy and you'll be hip, cool, and funky. Start your busy work-from-home morning with our coffee, and you'll live in a cool loft in Soho and have great clothes. If you buy our detergent, you'll find yourself walking on the beach with your baby in one hand and your promotion letter in the other. Practicing critical awareness. There are expectations that women can do it all. The superwoman syndrome. Despite my best efforts and the lessons I've learned, I sometimes still think I can do it all. And all at the same time. I think the expectation exists as a result of women striving for equality in the workforce, yet not getting the support and help that is necessary for real equality. I also think the need to do it all at the same time, especially work and mothering, is related to the fact that we view motherhood as unpaid, unimportant, easy work. The reality is that raising children is more difficult and rewarding than any job I've ever had. You just don't get formally evaluated, validated, or paid. Lastly, the entire debate over going back to work versus staying at home is reserved for women who have the resources to think of work as an option. We often blame women for taking on too much, for choosing the superwoman lifestyle. Many women have to do it all, or their kids don't eat. For me, part of practicing critical awareness is constantly decoding messages. Sometimes when people make comments about our choices, it feels shaming and we don't know why. Here are some of the conflicting underlying messages that fuel our shame and self-doubt. You are what you earn. Motherhood is easy. What else do you do? You should have a real job. You need your own money and identity. You should be at home. That's your job. If you were a better mother or a better professional, you could do both easily. Reaching out. When it comes to my personal struggles with appearance, family, parenting, motherhood, and work, I'm 100% dependent on my connection network. I depend on them for advice, guidance, support, feedback, validation, praise, and sometimes I need them for plain old hand-holding or babysitting. I've worked very hard to build this network. It's now big and strong. I also depend on these people to lean on me. I know it sounds funny, but I want to be in relationships that work both ways. Receiving empathy is a wonderful gift, but so is offering it. Both giving and receiving make me a better person and help increase my shame resilience. My shame web around these issues is primarily the media and myself. I constantly work on it, but I'm still vulnerable to magazines and movies. I have to be vigilant about practicing critical awareness and talking to my connection network about these topics. There are also friends and family members who can push buttons, especially about parenting and work. Speaking shame. If the goal of speaking shame is learning how to express how we feel and ask for what we need, then I'd say I'm getting better. I'm definitely better at the former. Like many women, I often find it difficult to ask for what I need, especially if I need help or support. During the interview, an interesting pattern emerged around help-seeking. It seems that many women struggle to ask for help or support. So often, we are the caregivers and helpers. We convince ourselves that we shouldn't need help, so we don't ask for it. Then we get angry or hurt because no one offers. We think, doesn't he see me drowning, or why won't she do something? This can quickly escalate into a blame and shame situation. We need help, but we don't ask for it. We get angry because we don't get it. We feel ashamed for even thinking someone would help us when we knew they wouldn't. For me, asking for help is a work in progress. Growth and goal setting. As we become more fluent in speaking shame, the power and meaning behind words become more apparent. Women with high levels of shame resilience use very different language from women who are struggling with shame in the same area. For example, when I spoke to women about appearance, motherhood, parenting, work, and family, Women who demonstrated high levels of shame resilience spoke less about perfection and more about growth. Some of the language patterns I heard include, I want to work on getting better at. I'd like to improve the way I... I'd like to do a little less of this and a little more of... These are my goals. I want to be perceived as doing my best at... I want to be perceived as trying. When we choose growth over perfection, we immediately increase our shame resilience. Improvement is a far more realistic goal than perfection. Merely letting go of unattainable goals makes us less susceptible to shame. When we believe we must be this, we ignore who or what we actually are, our capacity, and our limitations. We start from the image of perfection, and of course, from perfection there is nowhere to go but down. When we think, I want my parents to see me as the perfect daughter, all we can do is fail. First, perfection is unattainable. Second, we can't control how people perceive us. Lastly, there is no way that we can do every single thing that is expected of us or that we expect of ourselves. When our goal is growth, and we say, I'd like to improve this, we start from where and who we are. I'd like to work on my relationship with my parents is a completely different goal from I want my parents to see me as the perfect daughter. To illustrate how different these statements are, many of the women I interviewed described how their relationships with their parents improved after they stopped trying to be the perfect daughter. This also holds true for appearance, motherhood, and parenting. When we give ourselves permission to be imperfect, when we find self-worth despite our imperfections, when we build connection networks that affirm and value us as imperfect beings, we are much more capable of change. This goes back to the sentence that launched this entire journey for me. You cannot shame or belittle people into changing. This means we can't use self-hate to lose weight. We can't shame ourselves into becoming better parents. And we can't belittle ourselves or our families into becoming who we need them to be. Putting people on the loser board doesn't work. Shame corrodes the very part of us that believes we are capable of change. Goal setting. Women with high levels of shame resilience did not trade perfection for goals of working toward perfection. Building shame resilience requires realistic goal setting. Saying, I don't ever want to be perceived as impatient, is the same as saying, I want to work on becoming more patient so I never get angry. Ultimately, the goal of both approaches is still perfection. When I asked women about growth goals, like, I want to be more patient, I asked them how they saw that happening. Based on their answers, I saw a direct connection between their level of shame resilience and their ability to identify specific objectives related to their goals. For example, Cheryl, a good friend and colleague, told me her parenting goals are to be fun, strong, kind, knowledgeable, patient, and loving. She specifically said that these were her goals, and she knew it was unrealistic to be all these things all the time. When I asked her what she did to meet these goals, she very confidently started listing simple, measurable, they happen or they don't, tangible objectives. She said, I get sleep. I'm a better parent when I'm well rested. Even though it's difficult, I keep my sons on schedules so they feel good. I read a lot of parenting books. When they're good, I use the advice. When they aren't, I don't. When I see another parent doing something well, I ask him or her about it. My husband and I go to parenting workshops. I stay connected with my mother's group. I changed pediatricians several times until I found one who shares my values and gives me the guidance I want and need. I set boundaries with my work. When someone criticizes my parenting, I have a support system of friends to talk to about it. I try to practice self-care by taking the time I need to replenish my own well. When my well is dry, I don't have anything to give to anyone else. Oddly, growth and goal setting can feel like more work than dreaming of perfection. When we try to be perfect, we fail so often that we almost get used to it. After a while, we trick ourselves into believing that forecasting perfection is nobler than working toward goals. It is much easier to say, "I'll be thin by December," rather than, "I'll start eating healthy and exercising today." Or, "Things will be great when we get out of debt," rather than, "I won't buy anything on the credit card this week." When we set realistic objectives for meeting growth goals, we hold ourselves accountable for today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, rather than postponing accountability until 6 months down the road. Women with what I would consider the highest levels of shame resilience around the perfection issues had very realistic goals and concrete, measurable strategies for meeting those goals. One example was a woman who struggled with an eating disorder for more than 10 years. She said that she overcame her eating disorder and the shame around being bulimic by setting realistic written health goals for every week, rather than universal thinness goals. She said she no longer wants to be perceived as thin, but as healthy. And she works toward that by exercising for 30 minutes, 5 times a week, and eating at least 3 healthy meals per day. One of the benefits of growth through goal setting is that it is not an all-or-nothing proposition. Success or failure is not the only possible outcome. If our goal is to be a better parent, and we set 2 reasonable objectives of reading 1 parenting article per month and talking to parents who demonstrate skills we respect, we can still learn and grow, even if we don't meet all the objectives. If we don't read the article, but we learn a lot from another parent, that is still growth. And maybe we learn that reading articles is not our strength. Maybe it would be more helpful to spend even more time around other parents. When we set improvement goals and set measurable objectives to meet those goals, we can learn and grow from both missed and met objectives. If our goal is perfection, we will inevitably fail. And that failure offers us nothing in terms of learning and change. It only makes us vulnerable to shame. Going back. The ability to learn from our mistakes rather than seeing them as failed attempts at perfection is the essence of going back. Going back emerged as an extremely important concept in this research. Women with high levels of shame resilience in the areas of appearance, motherhood, parenting, work, and family spoke passionately about the value of believing that it's never too late to grow and change. They resisted being defined by mistakes and viewed imperfection as a necessary part of growth rather than a barrier. Furthermore, many of these same women emphasized the value of having members of their connection network who modeled going back as a powerful strategy for growth and change. Women were especially influenced by their parents' willingness to change and grow as parents. In contrast, women who spoke of ongoing shame struggles in these same areas perceived past mistakes and failed attempts at perfection as enduring and permanently altering their levels of connection and power. Like the women who demonstrated high levels of shame resilience, they were equally influenced by outside forces. However, in these cases, those forces were mostly members of their shame webs rather than their connection networks. When women spoke about the permanency of mistakes and the inability to move away from perfection and toward growth, at least 80% of them described this attribute as something they learned from their parents and/or families. So, the first reason that going back is an important concept in shame resilience relates to our ability to move past mistakes and failures toward change and growth. The second reason is its influence on our efforts to build empathy through connection networks. Not only do we need to be willing to go back and learn from our mistakes, we need people in our lives who are willing to do the same. Of all the insights that emerged from this study, none was more powerful to me than the influence parents have on their children. It didn't matter if I was talking to an 18-year-old or a 68-year-old. Women were greatly affected by their parents' willingness to go back and continually try to improve their relationships with their children. This was clear in all areas, but especially in the areas that fall into the perfection category. Of all the voices, shouting expectations or whispering quiet affirmations, the voices of parents were consistently reported to be among the most influential. When parents instill expectations of perfection in their children, it is very difficult for children to exchange that goal for growth and improvement. This is especially true when parents use shame as a tool to enforce expectations. Women whose parents demonstrated their own commitment to going back by encouraging them to strive for growth rather than perfection felt great connection and empathy from their parents. It is difficult for me to capture in writing the emotion conveyed by participants when they explained what it meant to hear their parents say, "I'm sorry," or "I understand how that made you feel." When parents acknowledge the pain felt by their children, really show empathy without explaining or defending, amazing healing can happen. Conversely, women whose parents continued to enforce expectations of perfection into adulthood either continued to struggle with shame or had to work diligently to develop resilience in the face of their parents' ongoing expectations. Remember the example from the last chapter where the mother told her daughter, "My God, you're still fat"? What if, after listening to her daughter explain how shaming that was for her, the mother had responded by saying, "I don't want to shame you or hurt you. I'm sorry that I've done that. I want us to be close. I love you." This wouldn't automatically repair their relationship, but what a powerful start toward healing. Yes, I'm sure at some point this mother would want to explain or defend her motivation by saying, "I'm just so worried about your health." But to really go back, it's important that we start by first just acknowledging the pain we've caused and our desire to rebuild connection. In my own life, I've experienced the power of having parents who are willing to go back. Before I became a parent, I wanted to do everything that I thought they did wrong perfectly. Now that I am a parent, I only hope that I'm as willing to go back as my parents are. I was recently talking to my dad about parenting, and he told me, "You can't parent perfectly. Your only measure of success is your children's ability to parent even better than you, and your willingness to support them in that process." I thought about that statement for a long time. It's powerful to observe your parents' willingness to re-examine their choices. It's even more powerful when you think about how your children will one day ask the same of you. One of the greatest barriers to going back is related to empathy. If our goal is perfection rather than growth, it is unlikely that we are willing to go back, because it requires a level of self-empathy, the ability to look at our own actions with understanding and compassion, to understand our experiences in the context in which they happened, and to do all this without judgment. I call this ability to reflect on our own actions with empathy grounding. Grounding. When we choose growth over perfection, we choose empathy and connection. I use the term grounding because in order to examine where we are, where we want to go, and how we want to get there, we must have a level of self-acceptance about who we are. Grounding gives us the stability we need to reach out and examine who we are and who we want to be. The more grounded we are, the less we feel compelled to defend our decisions and protect ourselves. We can look at ourselves with compassion rather than self-loathing. Grounding also prevents us from chasing acceptance and belonging by attempting to become whatever people need us to be. During the interviews, I met two women who had similar stories regarding their appearance. Both women had been very overweight during their teens and early 20s. Both women were in their mid-30s, very slim, and had young daughters at the time of the interviews. The first woman had great contempt for the person she used to be. She told me, "I was fat and disgusting. I can't believe I ever looked like that." She went on to tell me how much she disliked overweight women. She told me that her mother was very slim and was constantly on her about her weight. She said that she has two daughters and she watches everything they eat. She said that her oldest daughter, who was 7 at the time of the interview, was already on a diet. She told me that it was better that she told her daughter that she was looking fat rather than her school peers. I sensed that this woman, despite having lost weight, still had a great amount of shame attached to her weight issues. She appeared more rooted in shame than grounded in self-acceptance. The second told me that she had struggled with her weight for 25 years. She said she was an overweight child and didn't get into shape until she turned 30. When I asked her how she felt when she thought back to her life when she was overweight, she said, "It's just part of who I am. I got married and had my children during that period of time. I lost my mom during my 20s. Just like everyone else, I had good times and bad times." She said that her daughter and son were too young to really remember her being that heavy, so when they see old movies and pictures, they sometimes make comments. She said, "I explained that it hurts my feelings when they make fun of my old pictures. I also used that as an example of why you shouldn't judge people based on how they look. They love me and think I'm a great mom. I told them, if all you saw was a fat woman, you'd miss all the good stuff." They have become very sensitive about that issue with their friends. This woman said she felt great power and freedom about her appearance. She said she had a huge support system of friends and family. She seemed securely grounded in self-acceptance. Celebrating the ordinary and uncool. One destructive obsession related to perfectionism is the fascination with celebrity culture. We desperately flip through magazines to find out all of the intimate details about the stars we love and the ones we hate. We want to know who has lost weight, how they decorate their houses, what they eat, what they feed their dogs, you name it. If they eat it, wear it, own it, or lose it, we want to do the same. We want to share in their lives because we believe it's the way to bring us closer to the perfection we seek. Celebrities also bring us closer to another highly coveted asset, coolness. The importance of being cool should not be underestimated. We know that teenagers will often take terrible physical and psychological risks to maintain their coolness among their peers. Unfortunately, in our culture, the value of cool doesn't decline after high school. Women from age 18 to 80 spoke to me about the emotional pain of being perceived as uncool or unhip. They spoke as candidly about some of the life-altering consequences they faced as a result of trying to maintain a perception of being with it. Unfortunately, in a culture driven by profit, there are multi-billion-dollar industries making sure that perfection and coolness stay as elusive as they are seductive. There is no such thing as perfect enough or cool enough. In her book, The Shelter of Each Other, Rebuilding Our Families, Mary Pfeiffer speaks wisely about the real threat that the media poses to our families. She explains that the media forms our new community, a community far less diverse than real life. We know celebrities, but they don't know us. The new community is not a reciprocal neighborhood, like earlier ones. David Letterman won't be helping out if our car battery dies on a winter morning. Donald Trump won't bring groceries over if Dad loses his job. These vicarious relationships create a new kind of loneliness, the loneliness of people whose relationships are with persona instead of persons. In addition to fostering perfectionism and loneliness, which are often connected, there is the issue of comparing our lives with the lives of celebrities. We watch hours of shows that do nothing more than detail their comings and goings. And consciously or unconsciously, we compare our lives to theirs. In my research with both women and men, many participants talked about feeling ashamed of their small, boring lives. With very few exceptions, these participants were comparing their lives to what they saw on television or read about in magazines. Dr. Pfeiffer also explains this phenomenon in the context of the new media community. She writes, "The electronic community is less diverse than real life. The problems it deals with are not the problems real people face. Certain situations, such as young starlets being threatened or handsome men fighting crime, are overexplored. Other stories, much more common, such as school board meetings, poetry writing, trips to museums, piano practice, or the delivery of meals on wheels, are virtually ignored. People who are not visually interesting, which is most of us, are underrepresented. The stories that are selected are those that make money. A richness and complexity of real life disappears. In our culture, the fear and shame of being ordinary is very real. In fact, many of the older women I interviewed spoke about looking back on their lives and grieving for the extraordinary things that would never come to pass. We seem to measure the value of people's contributions, and sometimes their entire lives, by their level of public recognition. In other words, worth is measured by fame and fortune. Our culture is quick to dismiss quiet, ordinary, hard-working men and women. In many instances, we equate ordinary with boring, or even more dangerous, ordinary has become synonymous with meaningless. One of the greatest cultural consequences of devaluing our own lives has been our tolerance for what people do to achieve their extraordinary status. Baseball players who pump themselves full of steroids and hormones are heroes. Corporate leaders with billion-dollar salary packages are envied, even if their employees are losing their pensions and benefits at the same time. Young girls are starting websites and chat rooms to talk about the tricks that celebrities use to hide their eating disorders in order to stay thin and beautiful. Young children are overstressed and suffering from high rates of anxiety due to the overscheduling of extracurricular activities and the emphasis on standardized testing scores. These examples beg the question, what are we willing to sacrifice in our pursuit of the extraordinary? We can use the shame resilience tools to learn more about our fears and our vulnerabilities to cultural pressures. Practicing critical awareness is especially important if we want to better understand the media community that has become part of our lives. Fearing vulnerability. If we are going to recognize and accept what makes us human, including our imperfections and less than extraordinary lives, we must embrace our vulnerabilities. This is extremely difficult because we are afraid to be vulnerable. As I wrote in Chapter 1, we equate vulnerability with weakness, and in our culture, there are very few things we abhor more than weakness. When I listened to women talk about their fear of being vulnerable, I heard the same thing over and over. I don't want to share information with someone, then have them use it against me. It is extremely painful to share a vulnerability or fear with someone, only to have them use it against us as an insult, as leverage in an argument, or as a fodder for gossip. One concept that emerged across the interviews is what I call the vulnerability hangover. The vulnerability hangover directly relates to our fear of vulnerability, and unfortunately, most of us have experienced it. We have all been in situations where we're with a friend, colleague, or family member, and we feel that deep yearning to connect. Despite the fear, we feel that push or need to share something meaningful, and before you know it, we've let it all out. We've told them everything, shared our deepest vulnerabilities. The next hour, day, or week, that feeling of regret comes over us like a warm wave of nausea. Oh my God, why did I tell her that? What's she going to think about my family? Who's she going to tell? That's the vulnerability hangover. When we begin to work on our shame resilience, the need to reach out and talk about our experiences can be a very strong force. So strong, in fact, that it sometimes leads us to purging with people with whom we have not developed the kind of relationship that can absorb that information. The good thing about the vulnerability hangover is that it's universal. When I talk about this concept in my lectures, I usually see a room of nodding heads and expressions that convey, "Oh yeah, been there, hated it." When it comes to sharing information, it would be nice to believe that most of us have the ability to recognize the right people, the right times, and the right ways to share. But alas, the reality is that most of us have turned to people we barely know and thrown up vulnerability all over them. Harriet Lerner offers some wonderful advice on this topic. She writes, "When it comes to sharing vulnerability, it's wise to take time to test whether the other person is worthy of hearing our stories and to assess our own level of safety and comfort in sharing sensitive material. We want to trust that the other person isn't going to deny and minimize our pain or, alternatively, overfocus on our problem in an unhelpful way. We don't want to be put down, pitied, or gossiped about, nor do we want to have sensitive information used against us." Fear, vulnerability, and expectations. We also fear vulnerability because it is often related to our expectations and the pain of disappointment. Elizabeth, a woman I interviewed several years ago, talked about the shame she felt when she wasn't offered a promotion she was expecting. She said, "I was most ashamed because I told everyone how much it meant to me. I talked about it with everyone, my husband, my kids, my neighbors, my mom, and my colleagues. It's not that I told everyone I was going to get it. I was just honest about how much I wanted it. Instead of just feeling sad and disappointed, I felt sad, disappointed, and ashamed." When someone has the courage to share their hopes with us, we are given an important opportunity to practice compassion and connection. Think of how powerful it might have been for Elizabeth to hear, "You had such courage to apply for that promotion, and then to be honest about how much you wanted it. I'm so proud to be your daughter, friend, mother." As Elizabeth's example demonstrates, there is a complex relationship between our expectations, vulnerabilities, and fears. When we develop expectations, we paint a picture in our head of how things are going to be and how they're going to look. Sometimes we go so far as to imagine what they're going to feel like, taste like, and smell like. We put a picture in our head that holds great value for us. We set expectations based not only on how we fit in that picture, but also on what those around us are doing in that picture. And often the failure we feel when those expectations do not come to pass results in shame. "When I lose 30 pounds, this is what it's going to be like. If I get accepted into graduate school, this is what it's going to feel like. If we can buy this house, all of this will change. If I tell my father how I feel, he will understand. If I do this for my children, they will be very grateful." Sometimes broken expectations lead only to mild disappointment. But in many cases, they lead to shame, especially if vulnerability and fear are at work. Kelly, one of the participants I interviewed, spoke very candidly about how her expectations and fears consistently set her up for shame whenever she was around her mother-in-law. Kelly described her mother-in-law as very critical of the way she parented, very critical of the fact that she stayed at home with her kids, and very critical of the way she treated her husband, this woman's son. When we talked about her mother-in-law's visits, she described how she planned for weeks, sometimes even months, for the visits. She would go to great lengths to engineer situations that would allow her to demonstrate the kind of parenting and partnering skills she thought would please her mother-in-law. Without fail, every time her mother-in-law visited, nothing worked as planned. Not only did her mother-in-law remain critical, she also saw right through Kelly's transparent efforts to manufacture situations that made her look good. Regardless of what we do, we can't control how people are going to respond or react. If we lose 30 pounds so we can see the look on our friends' faces at the class reunion, what happens when there's no look? We can experience anything from mild disappointment to major shame. Kelly told me that she eventually stopped trying to predict and control her visits with her mother-in-law. When Kelly and her husband finally shared their feelings with Kelly's mother-in-law, she was somewhat unresponsive. Kelly finally developed other strategies for dealing with the visits. She limited the duration of the visits, and she prepared for them in a much different way. Rather than trying to control the visits, she surrounded herself with support from her family and her girlfriends. Kelly actually shared this story with me as an example of developing shame resilience. She said that she never expected it to change because she changed. She thought it would change because her mother-in-law would eventually change. I think that's the trouble with expectations. They're often unrealistic and placed on the wrong people. In the next section, we'll discuss an interesting exercise that can help us recognize our fears and reality check our expectations. The Life Shuffle. The Pregnancy Shuffle is a very powerful exercise that many hospitals use in their childbirth preparation classes. Expectant parents are given 10 note cards and asked to write one important expectation for their labor and delivery on each card. There's an assumption that families are